Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
Hi, I'm Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
Now there's excitement right there for you. So guys, welcome.
Set the mood. Set the mood.
Yeah, welcome to West Point, Mississippi, home of Mossy Oak brand camo. And
how did I know you were going to say that?
Lots of things that we love. And we've got two people on the couch. So I'll go ahead and make some introduction. I think this may be one of the, you know, we hadn't had many ladies in here. For whatever reason.
Same on us.
But we have Sarah Parvin, who is the young lady that's trying to grow the world record bluegill.
World record sized.
Mm-hmm. And what's the difference?
And then I'm not sure. But
we can get into that in a moment. We will do that.
And then next to her, we've got a fisheries scientist / biologist, Sean McNulty, from American Sport Fish Hatchery in Montgomery, Alabama.
And glad to be here.
He is. He's going to help us with some. We're going to ask some serious questions, Sean.
I'm ready.
Y'all are visor. Y'all both have visors on.
Yeah.
Y'all are the advisors.
Big folks get really hot, and you got to let the heat.
Yeah, no, I'm with
you. Got to let the heat out for sure. Yeah.
So cool the brain off.
I thought visors are for the coaches that get mad and slam them on the ground. So I hope y'all don't get mad during the podcast and throw a temper tantrum. Mm.
We'll see.
Well, hopefully not.
Yeah, Lanny, I'm glad to see you.
Well, I'm good to see you too, Bob.
You know, we've all been busy. I hadn't seen you much this week.
It's only Tuesday.
We saw each other yesterday.
A lot of moving
parts.
I did see
you brought the tractor back finally, the LS tractor.
I did.
We appreciate that. Other people would like to use it.
They're great machines. They're great machines because if Bobby can't tear them up,
nobody tear them up. That's right.
Look, I had a scare on yesterday. This Saturday, sent Toxie a picture. I was going along and I was watching and I ran up on a fawn. And it was a very, very young one. And I got a picture and got out of there. And then I got video confirming that the mama came and got her.
Got to be careful. What is it, August 15th, usually? I mean, before nesting, fawning season? You really want to bush hog too early.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Well, I was just kind of cleaning up around the edge. It wasn't a thick area.
We've been teaching the public how it's best.
He got excited. He got on that tractor. You know how it is. He got on that LS, and he just couldn't stand it.
This ain't no golf course, Bobby.
Yeah.
All the best biologists tell us to let it go, let it grow.
Yeah.
Don't worry about manicuring your place to make it look so good. Focus on the habitats, cover for fawns, don't take it away, and what do you do?
Yeah, you take it away.
I
really wasn't mowing it. I was cleaning out a little area that I was, so you weren't clipping? I'd cut some dead trees, some privet. I was trying to burn, and I was just trying to clean up right there so I could not step on a snake, is what I was trying to do.
And you found a snake.
I did find a snake.
Yeah, I found a snake.
A big one.
It was a giant. I had an exciting weekend.
Yeah, you did.
The good news is that he had sent me that, and he was like, it's so awe-inspiring. I don't know what the word is. It's overwhelming. I know in nature's like, whatever, lightning strikes or, you know, tornadoes or brilliant sunsets or just overwhelming to your senses, but there's something about the phone. It's just incredible. Oh, yeah. Or baby turkeys. I mean, the things we love.
Some sightings.
When you see them right at creation, it's awe-inspiring.
It really was.
And the phone is just like, it's amazing. I see why it's so wrong, but I see why people, because I've run across them, I see why people want to pick them up and take them home and try to raise them.
That, but yeah,
you cannot bush hog them. But they're so, they're so just, I don't know what the word is. They're so amazing.
It took my breath.
The sweetest thing in the world.
Yes.
I think on that, we've had a couple of small poult sightings. We might have had a late hatch, too, for some turkeys.
Yep.
Maybe it's just on people's mind now, but the internet seems like it's full of people posting a hen with 4 or 5 poults.
I just think the awareness is so much higher, and people are so grateful to have a hatch at all sometimes the way it's been going. So we definitely, I don't have numbers, anecdotal, but it looks like we've had a better hatch 2 years in a row.
It feels good, that's for sure.
And just speaking of that, you know, we're working on this website with Dr. Michael Chamberlain, Mike Chamberlain, our turkey hunting
wild turkey dog.
So it's called the Wild Turkey Lab. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it's .com, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot of information on there that guys can, and I think you can go to it now and look at it if you want to, but it's got research that's ongoing research that's going on for turkeys.
And you'll be able to follow Mike through the season, through the years, what he's doing, research and everything else. So check him out.
What a busy guy, though.
Oh, he is. But his goal with this was to everybody, and I won't say average guy, we're all average guys and gals, but non-biologists, non-scientific trained minds or whatever that love the birds to be able to really understand, access and understand all the research, because that's thrown around a lot, but I think a small percentage of our following our viewers, our people, really understand it. So I think it's exciting the years to come, what can be, understood by everybody there. Great, great, great concept.
Yeah. I'm so proud that we're associated with that. So, for sure. All right. So I'm looking across. We got a bunch of everybody's bushy-eyed. Everybody's ready to go.
I've never seen bright-tailed and bushy-eyed people before.
So, Sarah, give us just a minute here. We got to pay the bills.
Always got to pay the bills.
Lanny, guess who this show is brought to us by?
Today, I'm going to guess, is brought to you by...
You're wrong.
Biologic.
Yeah, well plantbiologic.com.
It's always brought to you by plantbiologic.com.
Yeah. And I think these guys, I hadn't even asked, but I think... So this show is brought to you by two different companies, the Moultrie Fish Feeders and the Texas Hunter Fish Feeders. They're both really good fish feeders. I think you probably use one of those.
We use the Texas Hunter.
Yeah.
Is that the square one?
It is the square one, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So
it's a good one, a really good one.
So, not to confuse people, but there's two companies out there that make fish feeders, and y'all should check them out. If you go to the Moultrie one right now, the MoultrieFeeders.com, and put in Mossy Oak, you get a 15% discount.
Cha-ching, man.
There you go.
I'll tell you one thing. The few feeders I have used, I like the way the fish feeders throw the feed out in a straight line. I've used them for deer hunting. And you can put them on, on the edge of a field, and it flings it all out into a straight line.
Mm-hmm. You can predict where if you've got cameras, you can get a lot better pictures too.
Remember that one we had at the lease?
Oh, yeah. That was a great one.
Directional.
I think that thing's still around here somewhere.
Yeah, but it was a fish feeder.
It worked real good. Sure
worked great. Moultrie.
All right. Let's turn our attention to the couch. And, we checked in with you. We had a podcast with you a year or so ago, and we learned about you and your father. It was a great story. Trying to grow these world record sized bluegill. How is it going? Where are we now? And can you give us an update? Get us started.
Well, it is, first of all, it is an incredible amount of work to operate any pond at this level, but with the copper nose. We have, since last year, since we checked in with you last, we have turned a corner where we are starting to head into a little bit of uncharted territory because of the number of big bluegills that we have. So we are very close to the 3-pound mark in numbers.
Wow.
For the coppernose. And it's real important when I say, because I will just say bluegill, but please know that I'm referring to the coppernose bluegill, which is a subspecies of bluegill. It is the fish that we started this project with, and to see these fish growing and to be able to go back and look at subsequent years of where we were, where we are today, we are leaps and bounds ahead of where we had planned to be. So, in American Sportfish, Sean over here, basically, Dad and I make the mess and Sean cleans it up. That is the working relationship that we have.
I think they feed more in their 5 acres than I do on my entire fish farm.
Yes.
Wow.
Water quality is a mess, for sure.
It's a mess. It's a mess. And we're going to be really transparent about it because it's important for people to understand. We're going to a place that not many, if any, have ever been before. And so there are going to be learning curves with everything that we do. And so obviously providing pelleted feed to these fish is one way to push them to their true potential. And they do have fathead minnows. We've got gambusia that are in the pond. I mean, there are other food sources, but pelleted feed is the way that we're trying to accomplish this. We want to grow the biggest copper-nosed bluegill in the world. So we're going to push the limits on it. That's what we're going to do.
I wouldn't be surprised if you already are in a sense. I mean, do you have any competitors out there? I mean,
if I do, they're tight-lipped, and that's probably very smart of them, because I came in and was like planting my flag. This is my market share. Like, I'm creating this lane. I do have a lot of people that have helped and been a great resource for us, like Bob Lusk, Bruce Condello, BigBluegill.com, and they did something similar in Richmond Mills, North Carolina, 2 or 3 decades ago with the copper nose. And I believe the biggest one that came out of there was 3 pounds, 1 ounce. And that is, again, specific to the copper nose.
Was that the Kingfisher Lake?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I've always wanted to go and fish that.
Well, you can't now. It's no longer fishable. It's not a pay guide fishery anymore. Apparently, the daughter now owns it, and it's a wedding venue or something like that. So that entire project, I think, has pretty much been stopped. So,
I don't know which is harder, weddings or fishing.
I know. Yeah,
I could tell you fishing is more expensive.
I just find it so interesting that you guys are pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Folks try to grow huge deer. Folks try to, you know, I had a stint of trying to grow citrus here in Mississippi. You know, just things like that. We're always fascinated with the extremes.
Yes.
Toxie and I are fascinated with hybrid oaks, which are uncommon. Mm-hmm. So it's always fun to be different. You know,
yes,
like
it is.
You know, I was always the kid that if somebody else had on the same pair of shoes, I didn't want to get those shoes.
I'm still
It's kind of the same way, you know, with what you guys are doing and so many other people are doing in the outdoors, trying to push the envelope and do something unique. Mm-hmm.
So let me start. Can you tell us how big the lake is, the average depth? And then, and Sean, I'd like you to weigh in too.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And where's the, is the water supply just drained from when it rains?
So it's a 5-acre lake. I think the average depth was 6 feet when we did the bathymetry on it. It was 6 feet.
What's the deepest part?
9.
Wow. So it didn't.
And that's just one spot in front of the spillway.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not very deep.
It's not very deep at all.
Relative. Oh, go ahead.
No. I forgot what else you asked me already.
Well, so the size of the lake, and then how is it? Is it spring fed or is it just runoff from rains?
We've got an underground well that we use there. And then there is a spring that runs down the back of this mountain that can feed into it as well.
So that probably helps with water quality somewhat.
Only in a flood. You can walk across their water in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And that's really when Sarah pulled us in on this, was to help with the blue greens. And, you know, you just have to keep the water quality better so you can keep feeding, because fish will go off feed once the water quality gets bad. And blue greens, the first time I met Sarah at her place, I could smell the blue green about a half a mile down the road.
The algae.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So is that from the fertilization?
Yeah, from all the feed.
Nutrient dense water. Yeah.
So they just so much feed they don't eat, and it's.
Well, and what they do eat and the waste.
What they poop out from it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was told early, you know, we've got this, Sean, you know all about it, this Perfect Pond fertilizer, Perfect Pond Plus, that we love, and so many people just use it to help grow bigger fish in their ponds and up the carrying capacity. But we learned that Sarah was advised, hey, you don't need that.
Absolutely not. I'm walking away if I hear she's putting fertilizer in it.
Which I won't. I won't do that. I know better.
So, and it's because you've got feeders going off 5 times a day or more?
It depends. We've not fed as heavy this season as we have in previous seasons, because we were really paying attention to that water quality. The second that water quality starts to degrade and go down, we put those fish at tremendous risk, not only from disease, parasites, but having a low oxygen event. And we've had two low oxygen events already. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, just now into the middle of July.
So do you have the paddle wheels
this year?
Okay, great.
This year.
So is another question is, like, the underground well sounds like it'd be, you can kind of flush the system.
We try. Yeah. Change that water out as like we can. But even then, you know, we're not doing anything out there in moderation.
Right.
Okay. So, like, I mean, we're pedal to the metal with everything that we do. So the large paddle wheels we have are actually rated. We have two of them, and each are rated for 10 acres apiece. So it's for 20 acres of current and emergency aeration. And we use those when we get into a low oxygen event to immediately try to get that dissolved oxygen back up. But we also use them to feed. And that is something a little bit different that not every pond owner does. We create that current, we get that feed in that water, and then we get that feed moving from bank to bank. I mean, it literally covers the entire surface area. Hmm. So every fish has the chance to eat.
How long does it maintain this, like, floating integrity before it falls apart? Do you have a special feed
that we
sticks together longer?
Well, we use Aquamax MVP, and it's a mix of floating and sinking,
right.
And the pellets are various sizes. So, but I mean, really, to be honest, floating feed can stay in the water for a while,
which is why it
is so important as a pond owner. You never want to feed more than those fish can consume in a 10-minute window.
Right. Huh.
And Dad and I, we say we have it down to an exact science. It takes us 3 hours at dusk to feed our fish.
Wow.
Like, manually out there, 3 hours to get the entire feeding complete.
Wow. This is every day?
Every day, seven days a week. And we time this with the wind. I mean, we know if the wind is not blowing in this particular direction, big feeding is off. We let the feeders do the work. If there's, you know, torrential rain, because our bluegills will not feed in torrential rain. They will feed in bright sun, daylight. But for some reason, in torrential rain, those coppernose will not take feed. Hmm. So we are, like, in tuned, you know, all day long. We're preparing for that big feeding because that's the biggest feeding that we do. Hmm. Out there, and if we miss one step, we could end up with a bunch of feed in the water. That's right. A problem.
Right. So with the feed, you were talking about, you know, the nutrient load and mm-hmm. how you guys push the envelope and how you don't fertilize. Is the feed acting like a fertilizer itself? Like mm-hmm. it's
yes. Okay.
Absolutely. As it breaks down, you know, it's full of nutrients.
Sure.
So between the feed and the fish pooping out, there's just
a lot.
I mean, you're feeding two pallets a month
mm-hmm.
in 5 acres. That's a lot.
That's yeah. a lot of feed.
Oof. Hey, we're trying to grow a world record fish.
Oh, here. You got to do it.
Can't be messing around.
We want to push it. We want to see. Right. Yeah. We truly want to see, can the coppernose go to that limit? And it's been somewhat controversial, to be honest with you guys. And now, if this was a 15-pound bass, everybody would be at a girl and me left and right.
Yeah.
But for some reason, when you say, yeah, we're trying to grow this ginormous, unprecedented size of a coppernose, people get all willy-nilly about it. And it's like,
how? Why?
It's just social.
I don't know.
Social media.
I don't understand that. Well, are they willy-nilly, like, on social media or actually in person?
Social media.
Yeah, that's right. That makes everybody brave, you know.
Yes, it does. The people mm-hmm. I meet in person, which are a lot of, you know, PhDs, sciencey brains that understand, hey, this is actually kind of cool because nobody's really done this before. They understand and they get it. Like, you kind of have to go into that area of, we're going to push the boundaries here and see what we can do. And obviously, it should go without saying, we are always going to put the safety and the health of these fish first. If we ever notice that, hey, these fish can't support this type of growth or this weight, we would have to pump the brakes and switch species or do something different.
Yeah, it's not like you're pumping steroids into the water.
Not at all.
You're just giving them a high quality diet,
high protein,
which is what fish use to
spoiling them.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say people that are taking shots at this have probably never eaten a coppernose bluegill.
Yeah.
Because the first thing that pops in my mind is a 3-pound coppernose bluegill could be the best table fare fish in the world.
It's a bluegill steak.
100%.
Bluegill steak.
I was going to bring that up, but
I'm sorry. Over flatheads, over crappie, over walleye, as far as if you can get a big enough steak out of it.
They're delicious.
Those pelleted fed coppernose bluegills are incredible. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of that, Sean, what can you tell us about coppernose and how are they different than just a regular bluegill?
It's pretty similar to the bass world in which the Florida bass, they get bigger than the natives. They spawn more than the natives and they go to feed a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. They're more aggressive, catching them on like jig and stuff. They're real aggressive too.
So are they just from a particular like river system or is it?
They came out of the panhandle originally and they've picked up everywhere. Well, at least in the Southeast, they do have a cold limit. They really don't do well north of Nashville.
Okay. Yeah. I've fished them one time and it was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. They weren't as big as your fish, but definitely bigger than the bull brim get at my farm.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I mean, I'm just curious. So the world record bluegill came out of Alabama, Catona Lake, if I'm pronouncing that right.
Just south of Birmingham.
In the 1950. 50. And from what I read, the guy caught it on a cane pole.
He did.
That's a pretty incredible story. Mm-hmm. But the lake was real. I'm looking at you, Sean, because I want to know. The lake was an old strip mine that filled in, a spring filled it in. The water was gin clear. What would have made that be so productive to be able to grow?
It's probably just low density of fish. Mm-hmm. And so he had choice of whatever he wanted. And then a fluke in genetics. Mm-hmm. You know, regardless of how well you feed or do anything, you've got to have some luck with genetics to break a record.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just hand pick one and say, I'm going to do this and it's going to happen. So,
well, that reminds me of the bass and from Georgia, the world record. It's almost hard to believe. What was really going on here? You know, nobody's with all these advancements, nobody's caught anything even close to that.
So that world record was just, is that called a northern bluegill? The when it's just the
native or common.
The coppernose came out of Florida. And when I look at the record, I was curious, what's the largest coppernose out of Florida? And they're 3 pounds is about what they seem to be topping out at. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you just go for that native bluegill and think that, boy, if it happened here, we could grow these a little larger? I'm just curious, the thought process.
Well, for us, with the fish farm, we're raising them. We don't do what Sarah does. We're raising for numbers. We're raising for easy for people to feed them in their ponds, to feed the bass and that kind of thing. So it's a different world from what we're doing and what she's doing. And Sarah can tell you that they had a fish kill a long time ago. And I think natural selection just got lucky and it had some really tough fish that it's the only thing that survived. And they're just pushing through and getting big.
So your fish are larger than the largest fish in Florida already. Mm-hmm.
We're in year five.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, we caught a 44-ounce one last time we were up there.
44-ounce coppernose.
But you're getting consistent big fish. Yes. You're not just getting the random big, you know, I grew up calling them bull brim.
Bull brim.
I can't even also imagine how hard that would fight on a fly rod.
It's unreal.
Yeah, they're my favorite fighting fish.
Yeah, pound for pound, they got to be tops. Kind of like, some of those saltwater fish that are shaped that size. They can turn
sideways.
Yeah. That's a lot of pulling against them. Mm-hmm.
So when we shock the lake, you know, it's incredible. You know, normally when you're shocking a pond, you'll see a big bluegill here or there. But you hit the pedal on the shock boat, and there's just hundreds of one and a half to three pound.
Big ones.
It's hard to focus to scoop the fish because you're just running around.
We always get so excited because I'm usually at the front of the boat with the dip net, and I'm like, Sean and I are communicating with eye glances, and then we just hit, like, we have this stack of old tires. We hit this tire, and it's just like you see these white, glowing, big discs just emerging from the depths, and you're like, God, are those bluegill? Mm. I mean, even we're sometimes like, holy cow, this is crazy.
Wow. So one of the things that we're doing is that we're shocking the lake several times a year, and we're culling 9 inches and under.
Huh.
That's crazy.
So when
are we having a fish fry?
A 44-ounce fish, how long is he?
It was 12 inches.
Yeah, I've got a question. Do you have any predator fish at all in there? It's just pure
bird. Okay, we have tiger bass in there from American Sportfish, but we have crowded them.
Right.
So they will stunt, and they're not reproducing.
No, you know, there's very few places where there's a situation called bluegill crowded.
Right.
Into which the bluegill prevent the bass from spawning because they're just annoying mm-hmm. them and eating eggs. And I don't think you've had reproduction in a long time. In there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So they help. So the tiger bass, I mean, they're, you know, right. 3-4 pounds. They kind of help a little bit with population control, but they cannot eat those trophy.
Oh, no.
Bluegill. Right. I mean, they can't even come close.
No, so. a giant bass couldn't eat one of those.
Wow. So amazing. You said, so the world, you're approaching it. In your mind, are you thinking you're 18 months away from having a – and it sounds like you're just trying to grow a fish in that class, yes. not necessarily that fish.
Yes. So I don't – we had started out thinking, could we do this? Could we grow what would be a world record fish? And there was a lot of blowback from that. People, you know, it's high fence deer. Like, that's, you shouldn't be able to claim a world record. And I saw both sides of that coin. And so I actually reached out to the International Game Fishing Association, had a long conversation with them because the rules very clearly state private water fish count. That's all it says. Does not go into detail. There's no addendums or exhibit A's or any of that, right?
I feed this much, so I'm not allowed, you know.
So, but after a lengthy phone call with them, which they were fantastic to deal with, by the way, they have said, well, timed feeders need to be excluded. If you are feeding a fish to grow, you can't claim the title. However, we would recognize the offspring of that fish should it be in another water that does not have a feeding schedule or timed feeders going off and things like that. So it was very interesting. And, you know, it didn't really like take any pep out of my step because I still feel like Dad and I are going somewhere the pond management industry really hasn't gone before. Yeah. So it's still very special to us to do this and to do it together.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, and to do it together.
Do it together.
Yep. And so it's exciting to see all the interest now and what, you know, several months ago, people were still sort of on the fence. And now all of a sudden, it's like we've crossed that hurdle. People are like cheering us on and they have questions and they want to get engaged with what we're doing and they have so much interest. So I am happy as we sit right now. If it never went any further, like, wow, look what we have accomplished and what we have done. We've got people thinking about these fish that were considered kids' fish, trash fish, supper only, now going, well, at 3 pounds, a bluegill is without a doubt a sport fish.
Oh, my gosh. Huh,
for sure.
There's cool. No question.
At 3/4 of a pound and 1 pound, they're a sport fish.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, I've always loved the copper-nosed bluegill since the first time we stocked them. And they're like, to me, they're kind of like wood ducks. They're just beautiful.
They are.
They're so colorful and so beautiful. And on others, I honestly have just been as enamored with them as the bass that we stock with them.
I'll go
as far to say I like pan fishing more than.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too.
They're so colorful.
That's me.
Well, when I was a kid, I had my grandfather, my mom's dad, and my Uncle Jack Cottrell, who was daddy's uncle. And both of them would take me fishing all the time. And it would always be brim fishing with a cane pole. Both of them. That is their passions. But so it was kind of ingrained in me as a kid to love them, you know.
Yeah.
And one thing I was going to say, you know, it really doesn't matter. And that's, I've gone to such great lengths. It's amazing just to see that commitment to excellence. And like you said, doing it together, the trip, you know, the journey. But no one can ever take away. I mean, it's like, regardless of it being recognized in the sport fish record books, there's recorded history. And if you grow the largest one in recorded history, you grow the largest regardless. So, you know, that's what you weren't trying to do it in like a native pond. It was a oxbow lake or something. You were trying to do it under, you know, with things you could control and affect.
Yes.
And my hat's off to you. If you get there, you get there.
Yeah.
So what, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I understand that's not a fair judge to somebody just fishing, you know, in the river or whatever. So all good for everybody.
It's still the biggest fish.
Yes,
still
absolutely.
That's what I'm saying.
That's right.
Well, and so many other people use feeders on their farm ponds.
Oh, I do, I mean, on ours. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So
So Sean, I imagine, and you manage a lot of punch. Y'all's company manage a lot of punch, and you always want people, boy, if you would just do this, or if you want them to kind of step it up. And it looks like they're doing everything you would want and more, maybe even more than
maybe
you would
a little
want.
More, but more. But no, it's really great working with them, because a lot of pond owners want the biggest thing possible, but they don't want the effort, the money, any of it. We can barely get folks to cull out bass.
That's right.
And so they get bass crowded, you know, and here we are. They're feeding 3 hours a day. We're shocking. We're doing all these things. And that's what it takes to break records.
Mm-hmm. I want to know a little bit more about like some of the instrumentation you use to test and some of those processes. Like, I mean, do you check the
You're going to be very disappointed in this talk.
I mean, like,
most of it's eyeballs and nose.
It's eyeballs.
Okay.
It's eyeballs and nose. And yes, every single day I'm out there laying eyes on that water. If I start to see something, for instance, our very first bout of blue green this year, I saw what was the size of a pinhead. And I said, that's blue green. And my dad argued with me and he said, no, it's not. And I said, Daddy, that is blue green. I got to call Sean. Well, I waited a couple of days. And by that time, it was building in the corners. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there was no question. I was like, man, I knew it. I knew I was right. And so I always like to be smarter than my dad because he's a retired doctor, right? And he is brilliant. He's the most brilliant man I have ever met, I've ever spoken to. And so I had something on him. I was right. And it took, 48 hours and the entire pond was lit up with it. So it's like, you know, you learn to really be observant and to notice changes that are happening out in this environment that you're in. And this is the type of pond you cannot turn your back on. Yeah. So I was gone to Orlando for 5 days here recently, and it was 4 phone calls a day to my dad. What's it look like out there? What's it smell like? How many geese are on the pond right now? Where's the blue heron? Like, I mean, it is constant check-in. Like, that, we're obsessed. Mm-hmm. We're literally obsessed with it, and we love it.
So what can you do if you have this blue-green algae? When you call Sean, what does he say?
Pretty much. That's what he says.
herbicides. The first year we got involved is already middle of the season. So all we tried to do was just thin it out so it didn't get too bad. And that was a battle. I think I was there every 2 weeks.
Yeah, for about 4 months.
Because if you put too much in and you kill the bloom, everything's going to die. So, yeah. But while we did that, we also used bioblocks and spread those around the pond to eat the muck on the bottom to reduce the nutrient loading. And we actually thought we were going to need to dredge our lake, but we did a sonar mapping. And after putting so many bioblocks out in this thing, there was very little muck on the bottom.
Wow. What's a bioblock?
Is like probiotics.
Yeah, they're freeze dried bacteria that you put in, and they dissolve and wake up and grow and eat. And
never heard of this.
Me neither. I gotta have one.
And I'm gonna tell you that I believe those were the big difference maker for us, because that pond is 28 years old.
Wow.
Never been drained. Tons of fish kills. With the last big fish kill we have being literally, we lost everything but the copper nose fry in 2018. You talk about muck on the bottom. There should have been 4, 5, 6 feet of that mess.
We did the sonar mapping, and one of our biologists was out there. I think we were shooting a show that day.
We were.
Anyway, she said, you need to come out here because either this thing is broken or I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see it on the sonar. We were push-pulling it to check, and there just wasn't anything there. You know, we've used these bioblocks before, but never in such a controlled environment. And it really made a huge difference.
Wow. Look at that.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does.
Fascinating.
Yeah, Max over here waving his hand at me. He must have some kind of good question.
No, the biggest thing that blows my mind is just the 3 hours a day for 365 days feeding. That's 45 days, 24-hour days of feeding. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a very time consuming. I mean, that in itself, I mean, shows commitment. That's not easy work. But really, my biggest question would be, what is the carrying capacity of this 5-acre pond, and how do you decide which fish to take out and which fish to leave in?
Well, with the fish culling, you shock it and kind of see where they're building up. And same when you do a bass lake, where they're stacking up in a bass, it's usually 13 inches, you know, and that's when people aren't harvesting and the feed and everything else, they get stuck right here. Mm-hmm. And so you start there and move those out. So there's more feed, there's more room, there's more everything for the bigger fish. So we started with 9. We'll shock again this fall and do the same and mm-hmm. see if 9 inches is still the right thing. But I agree with Sarah, the fish are getting bigger and there's more bigger fish. The last time we shocked, we had very few 3 and 4 inch fish. And mm-hmm. so it might be 10 inches this year or this fall. So it's.
So, Mac, when he asked that question, it made me realize that I didn't catch on that y'all are feeding in the winter as well.
We do. We don't feed quite as heavy in the winter. When that water temp hits 55 degrees or below, we will pull back. This past winter in Huntsville, Alabama, we had the coldest air in 30 years. The lake froze. Mm. That's the first time that I remember, especially in my adult life, seeing the pond frozen.
Did you do something to... Did you run the aerators to keep it from...
We actually turned off our bottom diffusers. We did run some current for a couple of days, but I mean, this was like, there wasn't anything. Everything froze. There was nothing that we could do. And so we were, for about 12 to 13 days, we were waiting. Are we going to have a fish kill? Are we going to see fish float? Is there any damage or harm that was, you know, caused to these fish? Because those type air temperatures do not, that doesn't happen
right
in Alabama.
And I forgot you told me they don't do well in colder climate. Wow. Because mm-hmm. they were on the fringe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had about a 2.5 pound bluegill that was stuck in the ice. And I actually walked out and broke that fish free so that I could look at it and tell, had it died from some other reason or was this what was happening? And I don't know for certain what happened, but we never saw a large fish kill or really any kill from that wintertime freezing. But to go back to feeding in the winter, the year before last, we had a relatively mild winter. Our water temps never went below 55 degrees. So we fed 12 months out of the year. And then, you know, even then it's a little bit of a less feeding. Once the water temps start to warm, the fish are getting ready for spawning. That's when we will just hammer. We will put the hammer down on them and we will get as much protein into those fish as they can post spawn and let those fish recover. So they just continue to grow. And when we did the last selective harvest, using the electroshock boat, which I think was in March, it was almost maybe not even 4 weeks of fishing after that harvest, I saw the direct correlation with removing those fish. That's how quickly that pond responded. And it was like, we're catching nothing now but giants. And I mean, it's every cast. So
I think we took 500 pounds of bluegill out there.
We did.
God.
Wow.
And that was the third.
50 pounds an acre.
Yeah,
it's a bunch.
Well, something like that. Do the math.
100 pounds an acre.
100 pounds an acre. Yeah.
So the math ain't mathing.
Yeah, I didn't do good math.
A lot.
So jumping back to the cold weather, the coppernose can handle it if it gradually gets cold. But if you have a cold snap.
That last year was, that's what we had, people had an entire podcast about it, but it turned the horticultural world upside down, right. Much less food plots. It was the fastest drop in recorded history. Mm-hmm. Of the temperature. And so plants didn't have time to get ready to temper themselves like they do. Even plants that can withstand bitter cold died because of how fast it dropped.
Mm-hmm. And feeding in the winter can be dangerous as well if you have a really high protein, high fat diet because they're cold blooded, their metabolism is slower. Nice. It'll actually rot in their gut sometimes. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of have to watch it. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of little intricacies here in what y'all are trying to do. Mm-hmm. So I asked earlier, do you have a date? Like, we think these fish are putting on this much weight. We think June 24 is going to be.
No, I don't have a specific date for anything. I do think that we are a lot closer right now than we thought we would be to some of these bigger fish. And I think with the next time that we electroshock, I will have a more definitive, like, hey, we're 12 months out. Because there is a window, right? There's a short window of opportunity to take a coppernose bluegill as a fry and create a trophy.
Right.
The first 90 days of that fish's life are, I mean, that is vitally important to taking that fish from fry to trophy.
So, well, yeah, I was thinking about that. It's like deer people want to pour the nutrition to their deer and expect results like that year. And so much of it is the foundation they built.
As
even the mom and how healthy she was when she had them and stuff. So what do they consume to make them? I know having a big, fat, healthy mom is good.
Yes.
But then what do they consume in the first 90 days because they can't eat the pellets?
They eat phytoplankton.
I got you.
Mm-hmm. So that whole ecosystem gets right. started with all the microscopic goodness.
Right.
And that's what they take in. And that is one of the reasons why we have so much structure and fish habitat down. We need that stuff growing on everything. Mm-hmm. We need these fish to be able to eat the second
wow.
they can eat.
Wow.
So, I mean, it really, it's super cool. I mean, it just is. It's a fun time.
Also, the more she talks and the more he talks, the more complex it is.
I know.
It, you know, when we first started, it was like, how could something like this take 4 phone calls a day or this time and attention? And now you realize mm-hmm. because not only is there so much work and so many variables, but you can't predict.
You cannot.
So mm-hmm. you don't know. You have to check it constantly.
And I'll tell this too. My dad had a stroke in his brain stem last May, which changed everything. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that communicating is for me and him. What's going on?
Right.
What are you seeing? How are you feeling? Like, so there's a lot of that communicating too that we pretend is because of the fish. It's not. We're checking in on each other that
yeah.
much.
So. Yeah, but that's so cool.
That's, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That's a much greater gift than the
yes,
fish.
It is. Yeah, yes, it is.
That's awesome.
Yes, it is.
I got a little of that going on myself.
Right yeah, now. I was thinking the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's to do with like farm. Did we get a rain on my beans or whatever? It's that yeah. kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. small talk that's mm-hmm. totally unnecessary. But
and if I keep necessary. Him busy out there, that's yeah. a great thing.
What so. A yes, that's such a cool story behind the story.
Yeah, they really. I'm yeah,
absolutely.
You kind of made me forget what I was going to ask,
sorry.
But Sean, I'm gonna look at you. So this lake is it? Are y'all doing something to stratify the keep the water from? I want to make sure I'm asking this right. You don't want the lake to stratify. Are y'all doing things to? Is there some kind of a pump in there that's moving current up and down?
There is, and this is where I'm going to get in trouble because I differ from a lot of people on this. Her lake is special. The bottom diffusers are necessary because organic matter on the bottom doesn't break down without oxygen. You've got to have an aerobic environment. That's why the bioblocks work so well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, stratifying in a lake, you know, when you go fishing, the fish are usually on that thermocline where it's cooler. Mm-hmm. And they're more comfortable and they're not stressed. So a lot of times I feel when you destratify a lake, you're giving yourself insurance to not have a turnover, mm-hmm. but your fish don't have that comfortable spot to go and relax. And so I think that hurts a lot of people's fish. But in Sarah's case, there is a bottom diffuser. I think there's probably
six
mm-hmm. out there, and it keeps it completely destratified. And wow. again, it's a different, every lake is different. But hers definitely needs it.
So all of y'all are worried like this time of year that an afternoon thunderstorm with cold rain, is that a concern?
No, because Dad and I both, those multiple phone calls a day, right? If we see that thunderstorm coming, one of us is out there and has the paddle wheels on preemptively. Like we're ready. Right. We are ready. We're gonna just go ahead and get ahead of it. We're not taking any chances. And so the year that we lost all the fish – a storm had come through and actually knocked out power to those paddle wheels. And we could not have that emergency aeration. And it took 24 hours and that pond had flipped. We were wow. done.
So you got a generator now.
Well, we are ready. So I will get out there with a lawnmower, a leaf blower, like whatever I have to do to get that water moving and aerated to save those fish.
So right now, the bigger problem is not a turnover from cold water.
Yeah.
It's going to be if it's cloudy for a week mm-hmm. and the algae actually dies. And then you don't have anything producing oxygen.
Right.
One rain is not going to hurt her pond. So.
But we pretend like it is. It's like our fire drill. We're always like ready to go. But we did have a couple of days where it was cloudy. It was overcast. And we had fish at the surface. And so that's the other thing. My dad is down there at 5 o'clock in the morning because that's usually the lowest time is that right before the sun comes up. That's when the dissolved oxygen is the lowest. And we're walking the banks like we're looking. If we see fish piping at the surface, we know we're in trouble. And sometimes it's too late. If you already see them at the surface, the damage is done. Those fish are hurt. They're going to be stressed down the road, which is going to, you know, predispose mm-hmm. them to disease. So it's not something you want to have happen ever. So keeping the oxygen up and the water quality is probably our biggest challenges.
I'm going to tell on your dad. this speaking of the diffuser systems, I was in Kentucky somewhere, and Sarah calls me and says, well, my dad turned on the diffuser systems and just let them run. So if you turn those on without a timer where it's a little bit at a time, you actually create a turnover.
You turn your lake over.
Oh. So luckily, it was early enough in the year. It wasn't too hot, but they had fish on the surface. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. So you got to be careful with everything.
Everything.
Yeah. When y'all are pushing, you know, to the edge, so those factors are more like, I've never even seen a lake turnover that I know of.
Oh, wow. I've had them turn over. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. I've had quite several times.
Devastating.
Yep.
I got a quick question. So on density, you know, population density, I know y'all are removing, you know, a lot of the smaller fish. And just thinking back, I mean, it seems like it would make more sense to have fewer fish in that pond. Is there just a magic balance there?
It's just hard. Managing ponds is harder, I think, than any other type of management because you can't see anything.
Right.
Yes. You know, you can't put a game camera out there. You can't just feed this one big deer. You can't do those things. So I think we talked about the bass aren't reproducing. I don't think the bluegill are reproducing a lot.
Huh.
They're reproducing some, but just not at the same level. Mm-hmm. So all we can do is, you know, harvest, harvest, harvest.
Yeah.
I was made a note for later, but I'll make the point now that it reinforces something really important to all wildlife managers. And there's a term that's really relevant to no matter what you're doing, and that's carrying capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to the degree you exceeded your carrying capacity, you got huge problems.
Yeah, that's right.
And the same way with deer, the only thing is, you know, they can spread out somewhat. But again, if you can keep your place under the carrying capacity, everything mm-hmm. will work in your favor. But that's a moving target because right. just like with deer, you have more. That's the one that comes to mind most that mm-hmm. you'll mm-hmm. pay the price for if you're not careful as deer, but especially in a pond.
Yeah. Right?
You know, and how do you keep it at the carrying
they
capacity?
They can't leave.
She's increased her.
They can't go somewhere else.
Yeah, her carrying capacity is probably 10 times anything normal, mm-hmm. but you still have to manage that. So, I mean, you take pressure off when you take them out.
For mm-hmm. sure.
And can I ask what you do with them?
Yeah, we have a weekly blue girl fries. I mean, where's the fish at?
We've used a lot for brooders on our farm.
Okay.
We've also sold some of the bigger ones to people who want to pay
good.
The mm-hmm. slab lab price. So,
hey.
It works out.
Trophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trophy bluegills.
For sure.
I mean, we're talking in intensive management.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
next level stuff.
I was trying to compare this to our nursery where, no, you know, like no. we still have to go on Saturdays and water. And this is intense.
Yeah.
So, well, you've got a team helping you there, Dudley. Mm-hmm. She's like on her own pretty much.
She made a great
Except
point.
For you.
No, I was going to say, this is my MVP right here. Like literally, we would not be where we are today without Sean and American Sportfish and every single person that works for him. They all know me. They all probably roll their eyes when I call, but still that it is all a huge team effort from them and what they do. And I mean, we are all kind of like, we're looking for resources. Like, what do we do next? How do we just keep this going? Because it is so incredibly intensive. So,
yeah. They're smart. They got a great reputation.
You
smart
mentioned, guys. You mentioned assessing things every day.
Every day.
What I found at the nursery is when you're there every day, a lot of times you don't notice the subtle changes quite as much. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I may go to the nursery every 2 or 3 days and you can see
you can
changes.
See it. Mm-hmm.
It's neat how that works, mm-hmm. but you know, we work together as a team and y'all do as well.
Yeah.
The Back one thing is very common though, Dudley, in the is that when the ox is in the ditch,
everybody
all hands on deck.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Speaking of, we need to get to the nursery.
Mac, let me ask this because I'm going to forget it. Okay. But so Sarah, when I was like 12 or 13 years old, if I'd lived in your neighborhood, when it got dark and you were inside
You'd
watching,
have had problems.
I'd have been trying to catch some fish out of your pond.
Yeah, my game cameras would have caught every angle of your face.
do you have problems? Those kind of problems?
We don't. We've had those problems in the past, but I think, and this is where I mean, this is what I want to naively think is that people are so respectful of the actual story here of me and my dad and what we're doing. They're not trying to be hooligans and come over there and just have, you know, shenanigans and do things. But the property is in somewhat of a location where you wouldn't ride up on it and be like, I'm hopping that farm pond. you'd probably be like, eh, I'm probably going to pass on this one. Hmm. I'm probably not going to get out there. I mean, there's, you know, electric gates. It's a big deal.
The mode of rattle stinks helps a lot too.
Oh my goodness.
Hop in that farm pond. So you know the lingo.
Yeah, no, she knows what
so
she's
you must
doing.
Have a pass.
Yeah. So speaking of hopping a pond farm, Mac, have you got another question?
I do. I would assume structure probably plays a big factor in the stress level of these fish. And what are some oddball structures that would be homemade? Or then what are some more advanced as well that y'all like to use?
So when the pond was built 28 years ago, and I've got like Polaroid. You probably don't even know what a Polaroid is, do you? Do you?
Okay. It's the new cool thing.
It is. Yeah, no, oh, my gosh.
It's coming back.
You're right.
It's coming back.
It has come back.
Yeah. That's right.
But we have Polaroids of when the pond was being dug out. And back then, you know, 28 years ago, there wasn't man-made, water-safe, non-toxic structure. You put in 18-wheeler tires, old Christmas trees. Like, you just threw whatever in there. and sometimes even with, like, the specific type of tree you put in, you have to be careful because they produce tannins and things that can, you know, not be good for the water. But we've got the big, like, Department of Transportation concrete culverts that they use for, road building. But we've got channels cut. We've got berms built up, gravel tops. Over the years, a lot of that has softened. The edges have, just because of the way that the water has been. And we just recently added in some man-made habitat, that's in like spawning beds, things like that, that have made such a big difference. I mean, you can see sometimes when our water will get pretty clear across the top, you can see some of the tops of the structure and everything that's growing on it. And that's what we want. It also helps those fish to have a place to go to stay away from the birds, which are a big problem. The blue herons are a huge problem. The geese are a problem. Everything out there is a problem. So we've got some ospreys that have come in now. Mm. We have the bald eagle.
Oh, yeah.
That we actually love the bald eagle. We love Baldy. We built a statue for him out on the property. It's about 20 feet tall. It's a bronze eagle. And Baldy is very comfortable with my dad. He will come and eat right in front of my dad. So,
cool.
Yeah, you're sharing a little bit.
We're sharing the space. Listen,
just don't eat the big one.
We're hoping they can't. We're like, there's no way that fish is picking up that 3-pound fit.
Shoot, an eagle.
That eagle's got it.
He got it.
That eagle's got it.
Can you just weigh and measure that before you eat it, please?
Do a catch release, please. I'm trying to get the slot line.
No cormorants.
Oh, yep. Got two of them. I got the phone call this morning on the way here.
Oh, no.
Sure did. We haven't seen them in a couple of years, too.
Nightmare for us. Well, they couldn't. They can't. They probably could spare. I've seen 4-pound bass with spear marks on them and stuff. I mean, they've tried.
Yeah, for sure.
They're the most evil thing to me in all of aqua sports.
No
they're
doubt.
Evil, they're pure evil.
Well, let's talk about fishing.
Okay.
What's it like to go out there? And so the way you're describing these, I'm thinking you could take a bass lure, like a Rapala DT6. Rapala. And, I don't know how you – that's how I pronounce it.
Rapala.
So, come on.
I think it is Rapala.
I thought you were from Alabama.
It is not Rapala.
It's Rapala. You're turning on your southern culture.
No, I went fishing with a guy that knows the family that owns it. I think they pronounce it Rapala.
You are from Alabama.
Well, I am from Alabama, but let me finish my question, please. like a normal crankbait that you would fish for bass, I think you would catch some of these brim on, right?
Absolutely. I've done it 100 times over.
I bet you a big beetle spin is poison on them.
We used to. So I grew up catching the bluegills with my dad and my granddad on a little bitty Keystone minnow.
Yeah.
It's an old school. Yeah. I mean,
the Winoski jig thing, too.
That's it. And unfortunately, we can't fish those in the slab lab because they're so small, they gut hook. So even like when fly fishing, I have to have custom made flies so that we don't gut hook on these fish. We upside hook, push the barb in, things like that. So, but we actually don't even allow treble hooks in the slab lab.
Hmm.
So
good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if a guy showed up, let's just say you've got a little, Sean, you're smiling over there, but like a little.
I just feel like you're asking for a trip is what you're working on.
No, I'm really.
Bobby is always working the system.
Like if you had a little you know, light, ultralight, typical rod, 4 pound line. Are you in trouble trying to catch your fish?
So he's tipping his hand right now.
That's right. You will scream with that. That's the setup I use. So I've got every kind of rod, reel, I mean, gadget, everything you can think of. What I have gone to is my dad had a custom made rod back in the 80s. It's 5 foot micro light. I mean, that rod, I mean, you just, it recoils when that, I mean, it just goes all the way back when those big bluegill hit it. That rod is the most fun you can have legally. With a 4 pound test, a little thousand size reel, just a little bitty jig head hook on there. And then we've got these little 2 inch soft plastic minnows that we use and all day long. It's just left and right all day long. It's absurd.
Yeah.
That sounds like fun.
And I never thought about them swallowing that bait like that. And so while we've got you, Sean, let me ask, if you're fishing there or on the river and you gut hook a bass, what do you do as a fish biologist? What do you tell a guy to do?
You know, depending on how far it is, if it's already bleeding out of its gills, a lot of times cut the line. Hopefully it'll digest the hook. But most of the time, if you can get your finger in the bend of the hook and push it in, it'll come back out. As long as you're not bleeding through the gills, most of them survive. You know, and again, temperature's dependent, everything else. So
colder would be easier.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would think.
Wow. Well, this has been really interesting.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. I love that she and he and they brought the spotlight to a way underrated, unbelievable sport fish and
cool fish.
You know, wild game species that we celebrate all of that as gamekeepers, but this one doesn't get ever, you know, it's kind of lost in the shadow, just like a lot of stuff's lost in the shadow of, you know, the 200-inch whitetail chase. This gets lost in the shadow of trophy bass and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, yeah, we stock them because they're the perfect partner to a healthy bass population. But until they're self, are such a great game fish and species. So I just love, I think, however much this reaches out there will stimulate people to take better care of what they have, including me.
You all have shell crackers in the
We do.
They don't feed as a certain. They don't feed on.
They are notorious for not pellet feeding,
right,
and they're bottom feeders.
Yep. Catch them on worms. We used to,
So they've got like pharyngeal teeth in the back. That's what they used to crunch those. So they stay on the bottom. We might have some surprises.
Yeah, I was going to say, I saw the other day you had caught what y'all thought was a hybrid. Is that right? So it's a shell cracker bluegill.
Yeah, I sent it to several people and was like, I need confirmation because my eyeballs are
surely you've got this in an aquarium somewhere guarded.
I said, my eyeballs are telling me that I'm looking at an F1 hybrid from the copper nose and the red ear. And I was right.
That's incredible.
So, and that we had seen one or two here or there, right? And then so day before yesterday, I was out there and I was fishing. I wasn't doing the work I was supposed to be doing. I was actually fishing. And I caught several back to back. And I said, okay, this is new to catch that many hybrids back to back, a couple of different size classes, but none of them were smaller than the 2 pound mark. This is interesting. So that has now piqued my interest, and I've got a whole bunch of research.
Let's dig a new pond.
Dudley.
Let's see.
You got a couple of hybrid geeks over here.
Let's, and I mean, let's see.
Where would you do to take it from there? Because you'd be the one to.
Well, it actually
where
happens.
Where do you go next? Would you cross one of those with one of the other in captivity maybe? Or what would you do to try to take it to the next step?
Well, if you're looking for size, you know, you probably get female copper nose and the male shell cracker, put them in a pond together and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if those hybrids could reproduce.
I think
you start a new species almost.
They'll reproduce, you know, because like the Georgia giant, which I absolutely hate.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's two different things and they're not sterile. They reproduce after that.
Right.
Most fish, if they can reproduce on their own, if they can spawn, they're not sterile after that. You know, we get the same question about the tiger bass all the time.
They're
you
in know. The same genus.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Lipomus.
But I can't think of two more, for lack of a better word, cool species than the old shellcracker and the bluegill,
right?
The copper nose. So That hybrid, what is it? What does it look like?
It looks very similar to the copper-nosed bluegill, but it's got that where the black opercular is, it's got that white ring around it,
right,
being solid black, and then it's got the lines across the gill plate.
Does it have the little stripes. Red on the...
It can. Yeah. So it depends, and this was the differences that I was noticing amongst these fish, is that one had the white line and almost like a tiger eye color that was in the middle of that white line, and then the other one had the notorious, like, there's no question.
Right.
But they have a little bit of a larger mouth gape when that happens, so it was very interesting to see. And then the shape of the face is a tad different. The we call them a gill cracker, just so y'all know that is
that's
the name.
A great name.
Yeah, the gill cracker.
Need to trademark
go
that.
Yeah, you better go get it right now.
The gill cracker has, if you're familiar with bulldogs and the big ropes they have over their nose, the gill cracker kind of has that rope over its nose, and then the demarcation where the helmet starts begins.
Yep.
So it's a very interesting fish, and obviously it's beautifully colored up. So it's got those.
Are they feeding actively? Because they've got the copper nose in them. It'd be interesting to see what happens to one of them, how big they could get. Because you would think they'd get bigger.
I would think you could push that fish.
Yeah, go for the bigger mouth and make selections. Yeah. I mean, you got a bunch of F1s, and they all vary. So you could pick from them. Anyway.
Man.
That's exciting.
It's another podcast.
Yeah, it is.
Episode 2.
Now, did you see that commonly? Is it because she's got such a, you know, a push envelope protein health level?
We see it quite a bit, but I think when I see them, it's usually more shell cracker. It looks more like a shell cracker.
Right.
So my guess is that it was probably, I lost my train of thought. So,
all right.
Probably a bluegill eggs that were hit by a shell cracker. And so you're getting more of that.
Yeah. So the other thing I was going to ask you that leads to that is that, so the timing, it's kind of the timing of the rut, the timing of the spawn is a real important thing too. And that's why crappie are not a good partner in ponds.
Right.
But bluegill are, because they spawn after the bass and the bass fry can just gorge on. What's the timing of a shell cracker versus a bluegill? Identical or?
So the shell cracker doesn't reproduce nearly as much as a bluegill. And that's why we're always heavy on bluegill in a bass pond. The big shell cracker spawn a lot of times is in March.
Wow.
And it's early.
Right. Kind of like crappie.
That's right. And so I think probably when this happens is it's a warmer spring. And so the shell cracker and the bluegill are on the same beds at the same time.
Wow.
Close proximity.
Yeah.
Stuff's happening and stuff gets, wires get crossed, and then boom, you've got this extraordinary fish.
Send some pictures. Well, I'd like to share that with people. I would love to see what that looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I saw a picture on
you. You did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's already there. Okay.
I was very excited about it. So, and it was one that I had confirmed. I had a couple in the past that I questioned. I even think we shocked up.
Absolutely.
And I was like, Sean, this is a hybrid. And I just get really excited because.
Dudley's gotten that call from
me. Understand.
Not very much different.
Dudley. Oh, by the way, I found a new hybrid in Atlanta last weekend.
Lord. Everywhere we go. Everywhere we go,
it's a northern red water oak.
But ooh, it's nice. Like for us, it's like you see something you can't explain through all the traditional, you know, explanations. And so this doesn't make sense, and you got to go back. And it's not always one, but typically it is.
Yeah.
Well, so would you, before we started recording, you were talking about the helmet of the bluegill and the brisket. Could you go back to that and kind of explain your thoughts there?
Yeah, so the males get these, what we call the helmets, and it's just this big, you know.
Bull nose.
Yeah. I mean, ominous look about them. And they will forage voraciously prior to spawn. And it's almost like they are building up their armor.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger and beefier that helmet gets, the more attractive they think they are to the female.
Wow.
But they also use it as a defense mechanism to ward off other males that are getting close to their nest. And they will beat the snot out of other male bluegills that come close to those eggs.
Hmm.
I mean, it's fight to the death. They're going to fight to kill the other bluegill. So those big beefy war helmets, they actually serve a purpose.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could, sounds weird. You could almost eat that. You know, they're so big. It's like a snapper, you know,
it
keeping
is.
The throats and the cheeks and all that.
Well, they're very, very territorial. And then you've got within the male bluegills, you've got, which we just did a bunch of research on, which was the sneaker male. Mm-hmm. This sneaker male is very small in comparison. He doesn't spend his energy building the big beefy helmet. He builds up his gonads.
Huh?
Because he's going to go in there. he's going to sneak in, and he will actually change his colors to mimic a female. And the sneaker will go in there and make it past the big beefy jock that's hiding and protecting the nest to make a deposit on those eggs, and then he's gone.
This is the same species?
Same
species. I'm not touching that one, Bobby.
Golly.
Who knew?
Well, now you do.
That's look at that. So fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Wow. It's incredible.
See that in waterfowl, don't we?
You would actually prefer him not to.
Absolutely.
Sounds like
absolutely. We want them out.
Yeah.
He would be what we call a cull, get out.
100%.
We don't want you in there.
But he's physiologically noticeably different.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. But to the untrained eye, he even appears female with the female colors. And they can do that on purpose. And I don't know what the numbers are. Like, how many sneaker males are there? I don't know any of that. I don't have a PhD in any of that. But it's just interesting to watch and to see all of this, because our fish got really, really shallow this year. And I was able to observe these big bluegills and their behavior around the nest. I actually got on video a female coming in, dropping her eggs, and the male showing her out. Like, it was just amazing you read about it, but then you see it and it comes to life and you're like, man, these fish are just cool. They're so freaking cool.
Nature is so
unbelievable.
And God and nature and all that.
It is.
It's just interesting how, in real nature, what is God's way of having that sneaker brim?
Yeah.
You know?
Diversity.
Diversity.
Nature is always adapting. We say
survivability.
Everything we do, nature adapts. And just like, the number one... Dr. Chamberlain's pretty much proved the number one buzzkill to goblin activity is hunting pressure. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? They adapt, just like whitetails become nocturnal, and so forth. They're adapt, so somebody else can breed besides the big bull.
Absolutely.
It's crazy how it continues to adapt. Even plant species.
Yeah,
same you spray way. Glyphosate for 10 years, you get a glyphosate-resistant strain,
Right.
Nature's always adapting, and whatever we do is going to continue to do that.
Well, really cool,
amazing.
Yeah, that's real. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
What else are we? What are we asking the right question, Sean? What are we forgetting?
I think that covers a lot of it. They feed and they watch, and we manage water quality and coal. It's not a lot different from any other management strategy. I think we have to be a little more careful.
Yeah,
the diligence level.
Yeah,
yeah.
24 hours makes a big difference in a pond.
It does.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Especially this time of year.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In our production ponds, we get water at 97 degrees.
Wow.
And shallow ponds like that, they just get hot, and it's.
And we do have that well. We can pump in 55 degree well water and bring the water temp down some. But it's this time of year where we have to be super vigilant. I can't just go and leave and do all the things I want to do. Like, I have to be there where I can react if I need to.
So you're headed right back when you get through.
I am, absolutely.
I bet. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And sometimes when ponds this green, when it's this hot, you don't have to lose your algae bloom. The bloom can get so thick, so when it's dark, they're respiring, they're consuming oxygen, all the algae is.
Yeah.
And so they can actually suck all of the oxygen out because your bloom is so thick.
Wow.
So it doesn't even take a catastrophe to happen.
Yeah. I took like 3 or 4 days of fisheries classes back when I was in forestry school. And just in that small amount of time, I learned a lot about how dynamic the water is from the course of, sunrise to the next sunrise. The pH can change 2 or 3 points in the matter of a day.
We watch that too. We have just a little test kit, and I go out there and do a little science experiment and try to keep an eye on it. And it's not like, hard and fast, great test kit, but it is enough for me to go, Sean, this color don't look right. Come up here.
Well, and luckily they're on a limestone mountain, so they have high alkalinity. The higher alkalinity, the better it buffers pH.
Yeah, a lot of prairie around there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of calcium in the dirt.
Is there a aquatic legume that could help fix oxygen in the water?
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen is what it...
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. That's
put that on the things to do list there, Matt. That's a great project for Biologic right there.
No, you wouldn't want it to take off and get out of hand. I think about aquatics and most of them are a problem.
Yes. Yeah. Anything that's not rooted on the bank is a problem.
Sean, it's got to be exciting to work on a project like this.
It really is because, you know, we do a lot of ponds and it's just kind of there. You know, right. People want it to look pretty or
guilty.
But
guilty.
Folks that's excited about it. I mean, it's just fun to do. And nobody's doing it. We get to do new things. And, you know, I shock hundreds of ponds. And every time I go shock it, it's just exciting. You know, it's cool. It's crazy.
But even not, you know, let's take the level of that they're putting into this. Let's push that over here. Just if a guy's got a pond and he'll put a feeder on it and he'll fertilize accordingly and he'll follow your recommendations, a pond is so much fun. It can be so productive.
Absolutely.
And you could catch some really big brim and bass following just the basics.
For sure. You know, and we tell a lot of folks that have small ponds, especially if they have multiple ponds on the property, do something different. Don't just do bass and bluegill. One of my favorites is in a small pond, put bluegill and then put hybrid striped bass in there because they don't reproduce. And you can catch a 6-pound hybrid while it's helping control your bluegill population. So,
speaking of a good fight, those things can fight.
Yes.
Do you like hybrids?
Like all hybrids.
No.
I mean, a 6-pound hybrid bass will strip a bass fishing rig.
Oh, absolutely. And so there's just a lot of things you can do. We did a whole show. We never left the dock, and we just caught big bluegill all day.
Like 8 hours.
Yeah.
Standing on the main dock.
It's incredible.
At this time in the show, we always kind of turn it over to Dudley, and it's called Rapid Fire. Sarah, you may have participated. This may have been before your time.
No, I think I did do this, and I messed up or something.
No, you can't.
So, you couldn't mess up.
So we've got a trivia question for you two guys later. The Rapid Fire is brought to you by our friends at Springfield Armory, and Dudley asks these questions, and they'll be from both of you guys, I'm assuming. So let's go, Dud.
So let's see. We're just trying to get to know y'all even better. So just try to answer the questions quickly, and it'll be a lot of fun.
My favorite fish is the bluegill.
We got that on there.
Okay.
All right. So are you ready?
Go.
All right.
I guess so.
Favorite season, winter or summer?
Summer.
I'm a big guy. I get music. Hot. I like it cold.
Music, country or rock?
Rock.
Country.
Tea, sweet or unsweet?
Sweet.
Barbecue, white sauce or regular sauce?
Red.
All right, Montgomery Barbecue Joints, Dreamland, K&J, or Brenda's?
Gibson's.
Gibson's.
Boom. Not even on the list. How did y'all leave Gibson's off?
Bob Gibson. I even knew that one.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm sorry. I apologize. Fish in the winter or hunt?
Fish.
Electric fillet knife or regular? Electric.
Regular.
Boat or bank?
Boat.
Bank.
Roll Tide Athletics or War Eagle Fish and Wildlife?
War Eagle.
Or I'm going to say War Eagle so I don't get crucified in here. But Roll Tide.
Fly tackle or spin tackle?
Spin.
I just learned how to fly fish. I'm going to give it to fly. I'm obsessed.
Last but not least, do you call it Lower Alabama or Southern Alabama?
L.A.?
L.A.
Hey, see how y'all are a great team.
I think L.A. was the only thing they agreed to.
Ying and yang.
That's what it takes. No doubt about it. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is interesting. Wow. So I'm going to look at Mac now. We've got a trivia question that we'll add. Y'all can kind of work together on this and give us an answer. If you get it right, one of our listeners has left us a review.
Oh, okay.
And they
gotcha.
Have a chance to win a prize, and it seems like we always give the prize away whether you get it right or not. So
I will say it with confidence one way or the other.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, so this is right in y'all's wheelhouse, so we'll turn it over to Mac now.
All right, so y'all are playing for Jake SW201, and the prize is some of Robert Arrington Deer Meat for Dinner's furniture in the front lobby.
We got a lot of it out there. Come get it.
What, Lanny? What is the deal? The whole front of the building.
I thought he was going to ship a chair up in here, but apparently he's coming to town. So
there's 40 boxes of furniture.
Don't exaggerate. There's 37.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot.
I needed a new mattress. Thanks, Robert. Yeah.
All right. So I guess since we're not going to do the furniture, we can just do a bag of hotspot from Plant Biologic.
All right.
All right. So the question is, why is a shell cracker called a shell cracker?
It has pharyngeal teeth in its throat that it uses to crack the shells open.
Man,
well, she got that right with
authority.
Yeah. She'd already
said it with confidence.
I would say that's like bonus points. So that, saying that weird word.
The shells of what?
Snails. Snails.
Yeah. Which you posted recently are very important to the pond.
They can be. They can be disastrous, too. So they can cause parasites among bluegills, even though they can feed shell crackers. They can actually eat decaying matter. And there's a type of algae they eat.
How many different kinds of snails are there that they would eat?
The black ones? I don't know.
So I have seen people in the Black Prairie shooting mallards on a cattle pond. And they're eating snails. Now, they wasn't like they had hundreds and hundreds, but I can remember, you know, three people killing a limit, you know, and they were just a farm pond, 6 acres or 10 acres, you know, cattle pond, nothing else, nothing planted, no grass, but they were coming in there to feed and eat snails.
Invertebrates.
Yep.
I had no earthly idea.
They literally had them and picked the snails with the shells on and all in their crawl.
And crawl. Calcium.
Crawl or crawl?
Crawl.
Yes, cargo.
That's a good rapid fire question.
That is good. I would piss that down.
So now we have one, since we're two of you, we've got one more. This is a bonus question.
Okay. It's your turn.
All right, Sean, you ready?
No. She got hers right. Now it's your go.
He's up.
All right, so the bonus question. Give us another name that a goggle eye might be called.
Stump knocker.
I hadn't heard that one.
I think he got that right. Yeah. There's a long list.
There's a long list.
So
every time we go somewhere, especially Louisiana, they have a new name for every fish.
That's true.
I just say yes. You know.
So I grew up when my dad was from L.A. And for the first 10 or 12 years of my life, I never heard of a bass. They were all called green trout.
Green trout.
You know, white perch, sock-a-lay. Yeah. It's
in they called them strawberry bass, but it was the original bluegill. I guess common bluegill is what you call them.
Interesting.
And for whatever reason, they call them strawberry bass. I don't know why.
Yeah. So
I think that's what also a goggle eye is also called a strawberry bass from the list of names that we had today.
Warmouth.
That's the one I've always called them. Warmouth.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody really knows what they are. Everybody just uses a different term, you know, warmouth. And, you know, warmouth and the green sunfish get mixed up all the time.
Is that we call them pool perch? That's a green sunfish. Yeah. Do they ever get in, invade your pond?
We've not seen one.
You know, it's crazy how they don't get in the ours. And now, if you leave a farm pond by itself, it'll be covered up in them.
Yeah.
But I've never seen a big infestation in any of our.
They actually only spawn once a year. And so they don't have a good chance to – in a new pond, they'll take over. But if there's an existing population, they're not
– The bass. So they're no big harm then.
No.
Okay. Great. They're a great trout line bait.
Love them. No doubt about it. My buddy the catfish.
How about that? I'm glad to know that. I didn't know. That helps me not be so fearful of them getting in the bass ponds.
Dudley, you got another question?
I think I'm questioned out.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's been really good. We've learned a lot.
Great stuff.
This is without question one of the most interesting.
Yeah. It sure has.
Podcast we've ever done.
Yeah. So, what else? Did we learn anything? Lanny, I'm looking at you.
I hate to say, I didn't know that a shell cracker ate snails. So, I learned that in addition to what I learned over here. So I was dwelling on that. I mean,
I learned so much, but just to see the commitment to excellence behind, you know, animals, wild game, and then sharing that with your dad like this, just that's really so special. Makes it so much cooler than just the story about raising the biggest one ever. That's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
I mean, so determined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell your dad we said hello.
I will. He will love that.
Yeah.
He will love that. He'll think he's famous now. So.
Well, he is.
Yeah, he is. No doubt about that.
Growing some big fish. Mm-hmm. And it is. I'm with Toxic. We're all in agreement. It's really special
what
y'all
are
doing.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
That's super cool.
Yeah, and protect that thing now. Don't let those little neighborhood hooligans come
in. I pity the poor hooligan that tries.
Yeah, for real.
It won't happen. Not on my watch. So
she's looking for blue-green algae all the time. She's going to see you over there on the pond bank, Bobby.
Oh, I will notice. If that's not the color cork I have ever fished with, that's not my bait, I will notice. That's not my fishing line in that tree. Like, I will know. So
be ye warned.
So Sarah, if a guy wants to or if somebody wants to follow you, what's your Instagram handle?
It's Sarah the Closer Parvin.
What does the closer mean?
That is from my background in sales and marketing. So basically, if you can't get the deal done, you call the closer. I come in.
Mac, put her number down.
Get the deal done for you.
Sean, do you even know what social media is?
I've seen it. The Facebook is out there
the
somewhere.
The Facebook. But that talking tick, whatever that stuff is.
Tickety-talk.
That's what it is.
Yeah, but so guys, American Sportfish, you guys have a page.
That's on the net, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The interwebs, as we call it.
Interwebs.
Yep, so they can go and follow.
AmericanSportfish.com, and we're on Facebook, so. I think we're on other things, but I've never seen it. So,
yeah, you can find it if you look for it.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
That sounds good. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Mac, you got anything else you want to add? Guys, we appreciate everybody listening to our podcast.
100%.
We don't take it for granted. There's a lot of things to listen to.
Watching the television show.
Yeah. So, Sarah, have you ever watched our television show?
I have, yes.
All right.
We need to get you to identify as a gamekeeper.
All right.
I see on your social media page you've got different things, and that's one of the things.
If she's not keeping game, then
I don't know who is. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
My dad wears the hat. I actually just posted a video of my dad and I fishing, and I realized he had his hat on, and he loves that kind of stuff. He just thinks he's high cotton when he's got that new hat, you know.
We'll get him fixed up.
We'll fix him up.
Absolutely.
Big deal to him. Real big deal to him.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate y'all traveling over here. It's so much better when the guests sit on the couch.
No doubt about it.
It is. So, again, thanks, everybody, for watching the television show. It's airing on the Outdoor Channel Tuesday nights, 8 p.m. Central Time. And we appreciate you listening to the podcast as well. If you can, leave us a review, and please share us with your friends. Toxie, you look like you're fixing to get up and run out and go eat.
I hear the dinner bell.
I am, but not in a big hurry.
Yep. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Mac.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.